Spirit Blade Underground, episode 350. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 350.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I started to kind of zone out for a second there. Who am I? Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and like me to hopefully live more and more for Christ. So for more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.net. But on the show today, I'm going to be very busy. As I'm recording this, it's Thursday, and then tomorrow my intention is to go and review Seventh Son and Jupiter Ascending, which, if all goes to plan, in just a few seconds, you will hear both of those reviews. And then plus, I'll share some reactions to the harmful teaching often found in geek entertainment, which you guys started a conversation on at the forums this week. So, all right, lots and lots of show. Let's get to it.
Displacement engines are charged for warp, Captain Franson.
Great, computer. Set a course for the uncharted territories.
By your command. And might I compliment your choice of clothing today?
Oh, thanks. Almost went with the blue shirt, but felt like red at the last minute.
Warning, enemy ships approaching.
Divert power to shields.
Defensive systems malfunctioning.
Oh, what?
Overdue
what?
For annual maintenance.
Oh, come on.
Incoming weapons fire.
Evasive maneuvers. Arm the photon torpedo.
Wormhole detected.
What? Wormhole? Where the frez did that come from?
Critical gravitational damage.
No.
Supernova detected within lethal range.
We got the
projected chance of lethality 100%.
What the crap is going on? Jupiter Ascending, brought to us by writer and director Wachowskis. All right. So this one's about Jupiter Jones, who was born under a night sky with signs predicting that she was destined for great things. Now grown, Jupiter dreams of the stars but wakes up to the cold reality of a job cleaning toilets and an endless run of bad breaks. Only when Kane, a genetically engineered ex-military hunter, arrives on Earth to track her down, does Jupiter begin to glimpse the fate that has been waiting for her all along. Her genetic signature marks her as next in line for an extraordinary inheritance that could alter the balance of the cosmos. All right, so this is the first, let's see, the Wachowskis gave us the Matrix trilogy and then also Cloud Atlas, and I don't think other than those two, I can't remember if they wrote Speed Racer or not. I haven't seen that one anyway. But they both wrote and directed this one. This is a story that's about a lot of political maneuvering and infighting among a royal family in space. And if that sounds boring, then don't worry. There's tons of action all over the place. You know, it's really just like action scenes interrupted by a few scenes of a romantic subplot between the two leads and decadent court politics in space. Now, despite the family infighting premise, I felt like there was very little relatable drama in this movie, which is a shame because I'm always game for some good family drama. I think family conflict is a great source of drama. But I think that the characters they were going for in this movie were so kind of high royalty, high court politics, that they had that kind of coldness to them that really kind of sucked a lot of the dramatic potential out of those relationships. The romance, actually, I think that the romantic subplot between Jupiter and the genetic hunter assassin guy Kane that comes to help her out is the best part of the story, but I also felt that it was underserved. I think they could have given so much more attention there. You know, this movie, you know, Jupiter discovers that she is poised to inherit, that she's actually a descendant of this royal family, and she's poised to inherit the entire planet Earth, and which is like this, the most valuable commodity in the known universe. You know, what Earth can, what is on Earth and what can be harvested from Earth. And what that means, harvested, is kind of part of the movie that I won't spoil for you. But anyway, you know, it, the story kind of taps into that desire, that fantasy that I think so many girls have, that they, you know, they all want to be treated like a princess. They all want to be treated like a queen. They all want to be courted, you know, by a dashing hero, you know, who calls them Your Highness, you know. And so I think it tapped into just some of those really core things that a lot of girls and women feel. And I think they could have tapped into that some more. Even I was feeling, you know, my heart was going out to this girl who was finding herself suddenly being treated like royalty when she was used to cleaning toilets every day, you know, and suddenly this guy that's sent to protect her and take care of her is calling her Your Majesty. And you can see her kind of blushing at that and getting all Twitter-pated, you know, and even as a guy, you know, my heart went out to her and I felt a little bit of what she was feeling, you know, and I just kind of loved that, you know, and it made her endearing to me. And so I wish that they would have played up those elements of the story a whole lot more, downplayed a little bit of the political intrigue and brought that romance to the forefront a little bit more. And I think we could have had a really unique experience. I mean, how often do you see in a sci-fi action movie the romance be like the main story? That would have been really interesting if like the political stuff would have just been something to get to connect the scenes and get us from point A to B and have that romance really be the central thing. I would have been totally game for that, but that's not what happened here. Let's see here. There are scattered Earth culture references by aliens, like it's as easy as easier than screwing in a light bulb, or look at her, the Beauty and the Beast, or something like that. So there'll be these little like scattered references of Earth culture, and you just don't get the sense that the aliens that are making these references have been like having their eyes glued to planet Earth and taking in all of our culture and stuff like that, so that it would make sense for them to speak using those kinds of colloquialisms. Is that the right word? And so it just seemed like the writing wasn't as thoughtful for the aliens as maybe it could have been to present them as these removed alien beings, even though the aliens I'm talking about actually have common ancestry with humans and they look just like humans, you know. Anyway, you can watch the movie if you really want to know what I mean. But, you know, people who've not been living on Earth at all are using phrases by people who live on Earth. So, and it, you know, didn't quite make sense to me. I would have liked them to be just a little bit more culturally different. You know, even like the political intrigue and stuff like that among the royals, it was just like, okay, well, we've seen this on Earth, and they're also quoting, using metaphors from Earth. There's just too much in common there. I would have liked them to have been different. The final result is ultimately a very forgettable story and forgettable characters for me. I think that Jupiter was just on the cusp of being a character that I could really be feeling for much of the movie, but she didn't quite get there because they didn't spend enough time, I don't think, on who she is, her hopes, her personal dreams, her personal desire for, you know, a romance that would sweep her off her feet. There were hints there, and they did play with those themes a little bit, but they didn't go near as far as I would have liked them to. Mila Kunis plays Jupiter and does a fine job. She's, you know, I'm trying to think of stuff that I've seen her in before. I think this is maybe the role that the first role I've seen her in where I really liked her and I really found her related. I really cared for her. And maybe that's just kind of an accident of casting or scripting or something like that. But I really did think she did fine in this role. And Channing Tatum, usually, you know, he's just kind of like the kind of roles that I've seen him in is just like this walking kind of like meat man, you know, who's just kind of like a tough stoic hero and stuff like that. But there were just some nice little subtle moments from him, and it was it was in scenes dealing with that romance where I was like, oh, you know, I was feeling something for him too. So again, nothing world changing in terms of his career and the kind of roles that he's played, but it was nice to see just a few little hints of new things from him that I hadn't seen before. Then of course we got Sean Bean in here from Lord of the Rings and all kinds of sci-fi fantasy type stuff that's usually smaller or direct to video since Lord of the Rings, but always a welcome presence. Really enjoyed him in this. And Eddie Redmayne, who is the guy who, I don't know if the movie's come out yet, but it's the one about, what is his name? He's in a wheelchair and he's a scientist and he talks with the aid of a robotic thing. That guy. Who, if I paused and looked it up, I would be like, yes, Peter, you use that guy's name, you know, in conversation once every 2 months. I don't know why you're forgetting it now. But these are uncut reviews, so I'm not going to do that. So anyway, you know who I'm talking about. But it's that actor, and he's been seen in a few other things since then. And he is creepy and weird and maybe slightly effeminate or at least decadent or something. There's just something about him that I was just like, which is appropriate because he's the villain of this movie. So, you know, my hat goes off to that casting. The stunts and visuals. There's these cool kind of like hover roller skate type things. There's no like, you know, wheels on them, so you can't really call them roller skates, you know, but he's got these kind of like these hover boots that function like roller skates. He's like, you know, he's doing these kind of maneuvers that make me think that they maybe shot the movie with him on rollerblades or something like that. It's an interesting kind of just sci-fi technology concept to be visually exploring in a movie. And so I do have to tip my hat to the Wachowskis for trying something like that. And, you know, that was something that I've never quite seen before in a movie. So that was pretty cool. The action and effects in this movie, they're all over the place. And they're representing Hollywood at its current best. But the action was a little too busy at times, and it lacked what I would call dramatic focus, you know? I missed the old Wachowski's bullet time technique, you know, which at first it was just used mostly to be cool, but at times it was also used to slow down and give dramatic emphasis to what was happening in the scene, you know, a really dramatic moment to slow down, raise the tension up, and get us on the edge of our seats and our eyes glued to the screen, you know? I would have liked a little bit more of that, or maybe they could have simplified some of what was going on in the background of a few shots to draw my focus in to what was really of dramatic import in the action scene. As it was the action scenes were often just kind of like noisy and just kind of like all over the place, just like okay. So anyway, the Wachowskis, as I look at this movie, I think about their history. They once innovated and created a new standard for sci-fi action, with, of course, the Matrix trilogy, and particularly the first Matrix, where they really innovated with special effects. They kind of got lazy, I think, and leaned on CGI for those same types of action sequences in the following two movies in that trilogy, even though I really do enjoy all three of the Matrix movies. I don't poo-poo them like a lot of folks do. But since those movies, you know, we've got Cloud Atlas, and now this movie, they've just kind of disappointed me. You know, they're not innovating in the ways that I would like them to innovate. I think they innovated in terms of some of the themes and storytelling that they did in Cloud Atlas. But, I mean, I hated a lot of the philosophy that was presented in Cloud Atlas, so that was a stinker to me. It was illogical and weird and, you know, anyway. So for me, after seeing this movie, Zack Snyder is my go-to guy. I don't think I'm going to have the same kind of anticipation when I hear about a new Wachowski movie coming out. I think Zack Snyder kind of took the ball that they were playing with and ran with it, starting with 300 and onward with his use of slow motion. And even in Man of Steel, you know, though he didn't use slow motion, he still was doing stuff with the virtual camera, you know, that was really cool and exciting. And I just would have liked a little bit more of that kind of visual action innovation going on from the Wachowskis in this movie. But we didn't get that. So in many ways, it didn't feel like a Wachowski movie. It just didn't feel bold, either thematically or visually. So it was strange. This did not feel like a Wachowski movie in many ways. Speaking of relevance, moral, philosophical issues that this movie might bring to mind or cause to come into conversation during or after watching this movie, this is the most, in my opinion, thematically shallow movie the Wachowskis have put out by far. And that's, you know, that's why I create two different categories for rating, you know, quality and relevance. That's not like a knock on the movie and on the movie's quality or anything like that. I just think it's interesting that they didn't seem as interested in saying anything philosophically in this movie, or at least not bringing that to the forefront near as much as they have in their past movies. There was a brief remark of a pursuit of profit over all else, you know, being the highest value among the villains, thereby them saying, if anything, that that's bad to pursue profit above all else. Okay, so good. That's, you know, that's not a revolutionary moral concept. They also, I think the movie, the villains say that that increasing human lifespan, giving us more time to live, is the highest commodity in the universe now. And that's a logical conclusion if you're coming from a naturalistic viewpoint where there is no life beyond this one, you know, that once our bodies expire, that is the termination of our existence, you know. And there might have even been, I can't remember, there might have been a remark about evolution and them achieving a higher form of evolution or something like that. I might be thinking of the trailer for Chappie before this movie. But anyway, I do think there might have been an evolution kind of comment from one of the bad guys, which is significant because it's not often, at least in the past, and more in the last 5 years, to associate evolution, which is usually thought of in terms of naturalistic Darwinian evolution, strictly speaking. It's getting more and more common to have that associated with villains, that philosophy associated with villains. Anyway, there was one statement that I really that really grabbed my attention, and that was when Jupiter was kind of wrestling through just kind of like who she was and stuff, and how people were reacting to her and stuff like that. You know, she was just like, I clean toilets every day. You know, I don't understand why people are reacting to me this way. And one character says to her, it's not what you do, it's who you are. And man, I wish that that could have been a theme that was played with a whole bunch, because as humans, it seems like our default position to define our value, our self-worth, based on what we can do, what we can achieve, what we have accomplished, what we're good at, how beautiful we are, the effort we put into making ourselves look good, or the effort we put into whatever, you know, like effort equals worth, or activity equals value, you know. And here we have, in this brief moment in Jupiter Ascending, this moment where a character says to her, it's not what you do that, you know, that people are reacting to you for, and that is the sum of who you are. You know, it's who you are. That's really important. So, yeah. So that would go against, I suppose, like the Batman Begins philosophy on the value of life. You know, where he says, you know, who I am inside, it's not who I am inside, but what I do that defines me. You know, that would be more along the philosophical lines of our default thinking, of the default thinking of all religious and philosophical systems outside of Christianity, which says that, you know, we are defined by the fact that we are made in the image of God. We are image bearers of God. And the fact that Jesus, God himself, loved us so much and saw so much value in us that he allowed himself to be tortured and killed so that he could have a relationship with us that would last forever. That's in biblical Christianity what gives us value and what gives us significance, not what we do, which is what you're going to see in I think every other philosophical or religious system I can think of. But you know, those little points that I mentioned, they are brief, they are scattered. You know, some of them I even wonder, were they intentional? You know, I mean, it's so buried and scattered. There was no, like, there wasn't even one or two major themes that were repeated and recurring through the movie. It was just these little little blips that could easily be ignored or missed. So I don't think this movie's going to lend itself to any, you know, worthwhile thought or conversation, unless you, like, really, that's what you watch movies to do, is to look for things to think about and talk about along those lines. So in summary, if I were a time traveler and talking to myself, I'd say, Peter, skip this movie. It feels a lot like Guardians of the Galaxy, but with more romance and fewer jokes. So if you like Guardians of the Galaxy, you might like this movie. You might really get a kick out of it. I think fans of Guardians of the Galaxy and fans of maybe particularly the Star Wars prequels, I know it's not popular to like the Star Wars prequels, but I don't think there's anything wrong with enjoying those. This movie doesn't have the cutesy kitty stuff and the Jar Jar stuff that everybody hates, but I'm talking about all the other general aspects and the way those movies feel, just kind of like this fun sci-fi that's, you know, just not psychologically realistic, and the writing's kind of sloppy, but it's fun, you know. I think that you might get a kick out of this movie. What I would say to myself, though, is, Peter, go down to your DVD collection and pull out Fifth Element again. That one was also bold and brightly colored in its vision of a sci-fi world, but it was much more bold and much more interesting and strange and unusual and alien than this movie was, despite the copious amounts of CGI in this movie compared to Fifth Element. It's rated PG-13 for some violence, sequences of sci-fi action, some suggestive content, and partial nudity. It's just a couple people's butts, pretty briefly. Quality score, I give it a 7.0 out of 10, and relevance, I give it a 5.5 out of 10. Seventh Son. Now, I'm here in my car because, for some crazy reason, the powers that be decided to release two what I consider fairly anticipated geek genre movies in the same day, Seventh Son and Jupiter Ascending. So I basically had to take my entire day off to go and see and review both of these movies. So I'm in between movies right now. I just saw Seventh Son. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this movie, what the basic synopsis is. Well, it's the same cliche kind of fantasy story. You know, a young man who's, you know, crossing over from boyhood to manhood, you know, discovers that he has this great power within him and this destiny that he's going to fight evil in a major big way. And a teacher comes along to help him understand how awesome he is and how needed he is. And they go off together on this quest to defeat this evil that's rising up, which is an old witch that was imprisoned for a long time, a queen of witches or something, and then she just kind of gains enough power to break out. I guess she just needed a little bit of time to rest. And now she's getting ready to take over the world again, and so we need a seventh son of a seventh son who has mystical, magical abilities to kill witches and the supernatural and stuff to save the day. Okay, so, the story. This is a cliche formula, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, that can still work, and, you know, if you're, like, a fan of, like, fantasy RPGs, Dungeons & Dragons and Skyrim and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's often very much the same kind of formula, and we don't really care. You know, I don't really care anyway. You know, there's some comfort in that formula. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. What I would say is bad is that there's a lot of rushed character moments that result in superficial relationships and superficial interactions between characters. And again, you might not think that's a bad thing because, oh, it's a fantasy world, who cares? These are just kind of like stereotypes of characters, caricatures, if you will. But the problem was that because they were trying to, I think, make it relatable to modern audiences, it's based on what I understand to be a young adult franchise. And so I feel like they were kind of like giving it a little bit of the CW treatment, trying to make teenagers kind of like just, I don't know. I don't know what they were trying to do, but it wasn't working for me. If the characters would have been maybe a little bit more extreme or intense in who they were, then maybe it would have made more sense to me that they would interact with each other the way that they did. But as it was, there was a lot of both psychological unrealism and biological unrealism. So let me talk about psychological first. We have people that are otherwise normal, like the main character, Thomas Ward, who is the chosen one, you know, is very much like a normal young adult, like a late teens, early 20s, you know, type of guy. But he is accepting these extraordinarily crazy circumstances with very little shock registering in his performance and who he is, you know. So that was a little bit unfortunate to me. There's a lot of biological unrealism going on. People are getting knocked around, and none of that is, you know, their bones aren't breaking when they should be breaking. Some guy nearly should have lost his head. It got whacked so hard. But he just kind of kept struggling and going along, and gosh. You know, this works in this type of, I guess, like maybe a family type movie. If this was PG, then I guess the choices of how they're handling action and the lack of realism in the action and the psychology of the characters would maybe make more sense. But I think they kind of want to have their cake and eat it too. They have like this really neat looking dark visual style to the movie, to the creatures, to the sets and costumes. You know, it has a visual look that is fairly serious and down to earth. But a lot of the choice, and so, you know, you might look at the trailer as I did and say, this looks like totally my thing. I love dark fantasy. This totally looks like dark, serious fantasy. But it's really not that. It just has the trappings of dark and serious fantasy, where the content, the kind of stuff that's going on, the script, definitely more young adult, and in many cases, even what I would say, kind of a family feel to it. That doesn't mean it's going to be, you know, appropriate for all families and young viewers and stuff like that, but they have that sensibility blended in, which is, I think, is felt a little bit strange to me. So as a result of how they're handling the psychology of characters and the action and how it affects people or doesn't affect them biologically, it removed all sense of tension or suspense for me while I was watching this movie. I wasn't concerned about anybody. I was like, okay, well, he can get knocked around and, you know, have an experience that would otherwise shatter his spine, and all he has to do is be knocked out for a little while, and then he'll wake up, shake it off, and before you know it, he'll be fighting bad guys like nothing is wrong with his body and nothing ever happened to him in the past, you know. So, you know, it's very much like what I've seen in the Hobbit movies and Yeah, it's similar stuff like that. Okay, so let's talk about the cast a little bit. We've got Thomas Ward, the Chosen One, played by Ben Barnes. You might recognize him as Prince Caspian from one of the, what do they call it? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Narnia, from the Narnia movies. He does a fine job. I mean, I think he was definitely cast for the same reason that a lot of CW actors are cast on CW shows, because he's a handsome, cute, whatever, young man. But I mean, was he bringing something that was layered and had subtext and stuff? No, none of the actors were. And I don't think that's a knock on them. It just wasn't the material they were given to work with. Same with Julianne Moore, who is a wonderful actress. And she plays kind of the witch queen in this movie. And she does a fine job as just kind of that stereotypical mad wizard villain, you know, stuff like that. But compare her to Bav Morda in, say, Willow, another movie that was definitely targeted at families, not even young adults, but like families, you know, that had this, I don't know how Willow pulled it off. But I've watched Willow as recently as like 2 or 3 years ago. And aside from the brownies, you know, that movie has a lot of, it's very fun. But it also goes to some dark places, both in terms of like the action, people getting just stabbed horribly and stuff like that. And, you feel their weariness a little bit more, maybe not in like Mad Mardigan, but, you think of Bav Morda, and you think of like her obsession, and you just watch that woman's performance. I don't know the actress's name, and there's just something sick and deranged in her. And then you see her relationship with her daughter, and how tears come to her eyes as she's forced to cast spells against her daughter, who has betrayed her, you know. So there's just a lot more psychological complexity, relatively speaking, when compared to this movie. And I would have loved to have seen more of that going on, because clearly it can be done in a movie like this that's aimed not at like just adult fans of dark fantasy, but at a broader audience of families and things like that. But we didn't see that in this movie, and that was disappointing. And then we've got Jeff Bridges, who plays the spook, the teacher of the Chosen One. And I don't know what's going on with Jeff Bridges. I tried to Google this a while back, and I came up with nothing. I was like Googling Jeff Bridges chewing tobacco, Jeff Bridges. I don't know if you've noticed this, but like right around when he did True Grit and Onward, he starts using this affected voice. It's very kind of true. I can't do it, you know, but it's got this mush mouth going on. And it looks sometimes like he's maybe got some chew in his mouth while he's talking, or that he is, you know, has done a lot of, you know, tobacco chewing or something. He had just a touch of this kind of mouth stuff that he was doing. Again, I can't do it. In Iron Man, when he was the villain in Iron Man. And then after that, every movie I've seen him in after that, it's this full-blown, like, weird old man voice that I guess he's doing. I don't know what is going on, but I'm over it. I'm over it. You know, I guess it was kind of, I thought the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's interesting. He's really going for something here. And then he's going for that same thing in every movie we've seen since then. And I'm thinking back, this guy is a very versatile actor. If you think of Tron, there was none of that weird mouth stuff going on, or none of that weird affected voice stuff. If you think of Starman, yeah, he's a very versatile actor, so I don't know why he's just being hired and asked to do this thing, or if something happened to him. I don't know if even chewing tobacco would do this, or if he's even chewing tobacco. I have no idea. I just don't understand this voice that he's got going on. So anyway, it's fine for a movie or two, but I've just seen it too much, and I wanted something different, and I just felt like I'd seen this performance a bunch of times before. The stunts and visuals, solid action choreography, but as I said, when there's a lack of physical and psychological realism, it loses all of its excitement. But I mean, I can say, you know, yes, this was nicely choreographed, you know. A little too much shaky cam sometimes, but not a ton. But just there's a few moments it's like, oh man, why are they doing that? Oh, and you know, speaking of, you know, not being able to tell what's going on, just a quick jump back to the Jeff Bridges voice. There were times where I was struggling to understand him and understand what he was saying. And since he's the teacher, he's kind of like in charge of exposition sometimes. So that was a bumpy ride a bit. All right, back to stunts and visuals. Standard CG, plenty of it. It does it's standard CG. It bugs the crap out of me. I can't stand looking at it. I just kind of have to like, all right, there it is, you know. And especially when there's not other things in the movie that are working for me, I really notice it. So it fell flat for me, you know, but I think a lot lot of people will be just fine with it. So, you know, not necessarily a huge knock against it. And as I said before, very nice set designs, costume designs, and creature designs. Just the look of the world and its inhabitants overall, I thought was really good. I really enjoyed it. It fit my kind of sensibilities for a dark fantasy very well. All right, so let's talk about relevance a little bit. Is there anything of moral, spiritual, philosophical significance that might be likely to come to mind or to conversation after, during or after watching this movie? Well, I don't know, not a whole lot. I don't think it's very likely, but I'll just touch on a couple of things. One, there was a scene at the beginning that had a cross. They were like in a church, and so it seemed clear that this is taking place, and I've actually heard this about the source material as well, taking place in our world in like medieval-ish history time period stuff, you know. So Christianity, the history of Jesus, supposedly exists here. You know, we've got the crosses and the churches and that kind of stuff. And so against that backdrop, that often, you know, will lead me to have a, kind of a different view of, say, witchcraft or magic in a story, or the supernatural. And so, you know, you've got witches as a major enemy in this movie, but one of the ideas that's kind of being wrestled with is there such thing as a good witch? Are some witches good? Are some, you know, are they all bad and evil or whatever? And so I think that's an interesting question to kind of maybe ponder after watching this. Is there such thing as a good witch? You know, for example, you know, there are, I don't know, who knows how many today that practice Wicca, you know, which is witchcraft, you know. You know, so would we say that all the people that practice Wicca are like these evil people and they're out to destroy the world, you know? Well, no, we wouldn't say that. But at the same time, would we want to say that what they're practicing and what they're doing is good for them and good for others, or is it harmful? And I would argue that it is, you know? But I mean, this, comparing this to a movie like, say, Sleepy Hollow, the Tim Burton Sleepy Hollow, I think the whole good witch, bad witch thing is much more thought-provoking in that movie than in this one. And the reason for that is that so much of this movie seems set in a fantasy world. There are more than just, like, kind of like supernatural ghosty type creatures that the characters are interacting with. There's, like, an orc-looking type character, a big, giant, huge, like, rock troll-looking type thing, and there are dragons and stuff. And so, in so many ways, it feels like a fantasy world that if there hadn't been that reference to a cross in a church at the beginning, I totally would have just accepted this as not supposed to be part of Earth history at all, you know, a hidden part of Earth history and just a fantasy world. It feels so much like a fantasy world that that the whole good witch, bad witch thing, I don't think is going to be very thought-provoking watching this movie. There was something at the end where the elder teacher toward the end of the movie says to his apprentice, the chosen one, you know, everything I taught you, forget it. I won't try to do his voice because I can't. but everything I taught you, and he'd been trying to teach him through this whole movie how to be the chosen one, you know, and he said, forget it. The rules, don't be bound by them. Make your own destiny. And I think that is such a core value to so many people, maybe especially in America, where, you know, the thing we want most is to be left alone, to do what we want to do the way we want to do it, to not be accountable to any moral authority or structures above us. And so I think it's really tapping into that. You know, I mean, you look at the movie Frozen as a prime example of that. You know, there's a whole song about doing what I want to do and not being bound by rules. You know, this is a message that we love to hear, but it is a very dangerous one. It's a harmful one. You know, and it's not a strong point made in this movie. And you know, it's not that I look at movies that do that and I go, ah, evil, you know. It's just a symptom. It's just a symptom of a natural tendency that we have that is very self-destructive in the long run. So anyway, in summary, if I were talking to myself as a time traveler going back in time, I'd say, Peter, skip it. Skip it. You've seen Hobbit, you've seen Aragorn. This is more like that. It's just going to bother you. So just totally ignore this. Just enjoy watching that trailer one more time and realize that the movie is not going to deliver on that experience. It's rated PG-13 for intense fantasy, violence, and action throughout, frightening images, and brief, strong language. I give it a quality score of 7.0 out of 10 and a relevance score of 6.0 out of 10. I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
Well, with my crazy day of cramming in two reviews on Friday, that just wiped out, or will wipe out, I'm still kind of time traveling here, lots and lots of time. So I was short on time this week, and so one thing I decided to do was just take a different approach to In Search of Truth this week, which I like to do topical stuff every now and then, and I also like to draw from the forums when I remember to do it, to bring content to the show, to just kind of represent your voices and what you guys are talking about and processing or getting excited about or whatever. So in this case, there was a great conversation started by Changer4 on the Christian Geek Central forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Changer4 started things off by writing, "Does anyone else get really bothered when they play a game that is clearly condemning Christianity or just religion in general? I'm not just talking about the extremes like BioShock Infinite or Final Fantasy X, but even a more moderate title like the Souls games, for example, which I love," he says, "that just portrays religion in such a way that it appears undesirable." Sorry, I stuttered there because I realized that I don't know if Changer4 is a male. I'm just assuming that. Sorry. Anyway, Changer4 continues saying, "I'm gonna go with the what do you call it? The neutral male pronoun. Can I do that and not offend anybody? I'm gonna try. If I offend you, let me know. I hope I don't. So I'm gonna use he for Changer4 to be neutral in case Changer4 is female. Anyway, so he continues saying, "Heck, even Dracula's comment at the beginning of Symphony of the Night," and I know exactly the one you're talking about, "even Dracula's comment at the beginning of Symphony of the Night just grates on me every time I hear it. I feel as if I shouldn't be as bothered by these things as I am in some cases, and was just wondering if anyone else shares my sentiments or has any advice." Well, Michael.Withers replies by saying, "It bothers me a lot, but it isn't just gaming. I'm reading a book series by a local writer, and in it she says two things. I'll phrase it as close as I can get," he says. Quote, "One person can't save a whole world," unquote. And, quote, "Any world that could be saved by one person wouldn't be worth saving," unquote. He continues, "Now, granted, it makes sense in the reality of her book, but I don't think such things are in a vacuum, and I might have to have a chat with her someday. One big problem I see," he says, "is that these games and books, to a lesser extent, are written to an impressionable audience that will probably take the content at face value or just pick up on the general vibe. I really see it as an attack on our kids, or maybe an attack on us through our kids. Things are so bad that when I read a book with a religious character who isn't an evil, power-mad, manipulative jerk or a bumbling idiot or part of a vast conspiracy, I get surprised. Von Heppner and Taylor Anderson are both authors who surprised me this way lately." He continues, "Even in the video games I like, which are heavy on strategy and low on storyline, you get items like, quote, Council of Nicaea 323, in an effort to promote unity, church leaders make a list of what books should make up the Bible, although there are whispers that politics more than spirituality played into the decisions," unquote. Really? That, to me, is just a kick to the groin. There is no reason to put that in other than spite. And then I chimed in and said, "I used to get angry or frustrated, and still do sometimes, if I think that the material, especially," I'll just kind of add since I'm the one talking here now, "especially if I think the material is high profile and influential. It used to bother me on a personal level. It's more like, you know, oh man, they're attacking something that, you know, that I'm passionate about, that's very dear to me. But now my focus has shifted a little bit and I get frustrated because I think of the other people that are taking in this content and either being influenced by it or, as maybe more often the case, it's just kind of like giving them one more reason through the day to kind of nod and affirm in their own minds the harmful things that they already believe." And then I continued, but these days it's mostly just, oh yeah, that's what I said here. But these days it mostly just makes me feel sad to see it, as it's symptomatic of people who are taking a tragic, self-destructive path. And from a straight entertainment angle, I just find it boring and uncreative to once again make monotheistic religion look evil, ignorant, or hypocritical. The latest offender for me is Dragon Age Inquisition. And if you want my thoughts on the, just kind of like the dissecting the religious beliefs of Dragon Age Inquisition, what they're presenting there, I've got a video on it at the YouTube channel at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. It's fairly in-depth. I mean, the video runs at least 30 minutes, I think. But if you're interested in kind of like dissecting that stuff, then you can check that out. I also feature the audio from that on the podcast a few weeks ago, but with the video you can look at pretty Dragon Age Inquisition stuff a little bit too. Actually, it's mostly me just reading text boxes, but anyway. And then Changer 4 replied to my comment saying, I just finished Inquisition myself, and while it didn't feel as antagonistic as some games I've played, I was constantly annoyed by Androstenism's blatant attempts at taking Christianity's place. And Androstenism is the religion of Dragon Age Inquisition. Andraste is this female prophet who mirrors in some ways who Jesus is, or maybe who people perceive Jesus to be in popular culture. Anyway, let me get back on track. So Change of Force says, I was constantly annoyed by Androstenism's blatant attempts at taking Christianity's place, especially since the Maker, that's their word for God in Dragon Age, isn't an infallible God. His own holy texts admit that he makes mistakes, such as the creation of spirits. This makes him more similar to a Greek god than anything, certainly not worthy of worship. And that's without even looking any deeper into the teachings of the Chantry, which is, again, what I did in that video. But yeah, he's absolutely right. Those are my impressions of the Maker as well, that he really strikes me as much more of like one of the petty Greek gods than as the monotheistic God presented in the Bible, or yeah. So anyway, so I replied to that by saying, I wonder, as we only can wonder, what the intent is for creating and presenting a religion like this. Now, I don't mean the PR answer that they would give in an interview if somebody said, now, what's your intent in doing this? Because they would give an answer that would be very safe for their studio and the company, of course. But I'm wondering, like, in their heart of hearts, the guy that is sitting at his computer with, you know, Word open, and he's typing this up and coming up with this story and how he's going to represent this world, and, you know, and all this was done a while ago. They're just kind of fleshing it out in Dragon Age Inquisition, but all this stuff was present in Dragon Age Origins, you know, about who the Maker is and the story of Andraste and stuff. It's all there. So I'm wondering what that person or persons, like, in their heart of hearts, hoped to accomplish by creating and then presenting this fictional religion. You know, is it just simple entertainment by playing with a concept? Or is it criticism of what they think Christianity or Catholicism is about? Which parts of Androstenism do they think are identical to Christianity? You know, for example, Change of Four mentioned the Maker being more like a Greek god, which I would totally agree with. But many armchair critics of the Old Testament think of Yahweh as petty and flawed as well. So I wonder if the writers at BioWare are thinking to themselves, hey, let's blend elements of Christianity and Greek polytheism and see what it looks like. Or are they thinking, hey, you know, let's use this story to just kind of subtly call out the God of the Bible on his pettiness? You know, I wonder. I wonder kind of what they're thinking is on that. I wonder something similar about the gamers who take note of Androstenism, because I'm sure a lot of gamers just plow through that stuff. They're just like, ah, whatever, religion, backstory, blah, blah, world building, blah. You know, but I mean, I'm sure there's a number of gamers who are really into that kind of stuff. And so I wonder about those gamers who take note of Androstenism and the Chantry and all that teaching of this fictional religion. Do they see a blend of polytheism and the Bible, or do they think the characterization of the Maker is really just like Yahweh, with just some incidental details being different? Now, naturally, it's different for many people, but I would just be fascinated if they would do a poll or something to find out. I don't know who's going to do that. Maybe someday, if Christian Geek Central is getting enough traffic, then we could do a poll that you know, might be indicative of something. I don't know, but I don't even know if that, because we would mostly attract Christians. I'm wondering about, like, maybe the, you know, like the non-believers as a whole. but I don't know who's going to do that. Anyway, I'll close by sharing the response of Winston Crutchfield, Mindspike, on the forums. His response was actually first, but I saved it for last here. He brought some great perspective from Scripture. I thought that'd be good to kind of start to wrap things up with. He quotes John 15 from the NIV, starting in verse 18, which says, "If the world hates you," this is Jesus talking, "if the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belonged to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of my name, for they do not know the one who sent me. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not be guilty of sin, but now they have no excuse for their sin. Whoever hates me hates my Father as well. If I had not done among them the works no one else did, they would not be guilty of sin. As it is, they have seen, and yet they have hated both me and my Father. But this is to fulfill what is written in their law. They hated me without reason." And at the conclusion of the lesson, he writes in John 16, verse 33, "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." And Winston adds, "It bothers me as well regarding the topic as a whole, and think it is only because people generally don't like to be thought ill of. But there is little to be done about it. In the company of friends, I have sometimes made the comment that these things really aren't in the Bible or some such. In the company of my children, I make sure I take the time to correct false theology and point to actual Scripture." So to wrap up, I'd say that I think we're right, you know, to be frustrated and sometimes even angry about harmful views being taught and accepted. I don't think that we should be angry at the and outraged at the people who are doing this. I think we should be angry about the situation. But I mean, you know, we shouldn't be shocked when this kind of thing happens, when it's coming from, from unbelievers. That's just the natural human default. And you'll find it happening in the church sometimes too. But I think being aware and discerning of bad teaching and using those, maybe those emotional triggers that happen as a reminder, you know what, let me hit the pause button and let me just take 2 minutes here and just disconnect from what I'm doing. Think of the real-world ramifications that this is having on other people who are taking in this content and the people who are creating this content. Use that emotional trigger as a reminder to, you know, hit the pause button and just take 2 minutes to pray for those teachers, for their audience. And then, you know, after you, hit the pause button again, finish your game, stuff like that, maybe think about ways to talk about it and sort through it all with other people that you know, other people that you're sitting with and playing the game, or maybe jumping on the forums and, you know, like Change Your Four did, and just kind of processing this thing with others. I think that's a really good start for how we ought to respond as believers. So thank you, Change Your Four, and everyone who participated in that discussion. Anyone interested, you know, we can keep that thread going. I would love to see what more that we can gain from it if you guys are interested in that. You'll find it in the Seeking Truth section of the forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com. All right, feedback, input, I want to hear from you. How can I make this show better? How can I make it worse? You can request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, really whatever's on your mind, guys. It all helps me make the show better. So please go to spiritblade.net/underground, where you can record a message with your computer, or you can send me an email, either typed or like attach your own audio message to it, at Pater, P-A-E-T-E-R, at spiritblade.net. And if you want to check out this week's review content, which... if you heard two reviews, then both video versions of those should be up. If you only heard one, then only one will be up. But anyway, this week's review content, you can get the full uncut video version of it at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. A reminder that we're looking for CGC scanners, people who are into geeky stuff and want to keep us in the loop on it. And just in general, guys, I want to expand the number of Christian geek voices being represented at Christian Geek Central. So if you want to explore any of that with me, shoot me an email for more info at P-A-E-T-E-R at Spirit. spiritblade.net. A couple of articles that I haven't talked about yet that have been posted at Christian Geek Central that I definitely encourage you guys to check out. The first is a CGC scanner post. For news, it's Newsnet Comics number 3 by Tim O'Donnell, who kind of keeps us in the loop on the happenings in the world of superheroes. And then also, Rhetus Octon wrote the an intro to Saving the Game, which is another Christian Geek podcast that is definitely worth checking out, guys. So go check out both of those articles at christiangeekcentral.com. Again, I want to thank everyone who participated in the Opposing Views in Games thread on the forums at Christian Geek Central. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, oh my gosh, what is happening next week? Hang on. Ooh, next week is another week with a few different possibilities. I've recorded a CGC uncut review for Birdman, which comes out on Blu-ray on February 17th, and I saw it in the theater recently, so I'll be putting that video up and featuring the audio from that review next week. And then I may or may not also review Kingsman, which is based on a comic book. It's kind of like a crazy-looking spy movie, but... and then I had something else that was kind of Valentine's Day themed, but I think I might save that for next year. And then some other stuff that might happen. So anyway, we'll see. We'll see what God plans for and allows for next week. Till then, thanks so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Friends and with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
Okay, so that was A Clockwork Nabari, Season 2, Farscape. my gosh. I said at the end of the last time that it was the opening scene that I remembered. That's actually wrong. I misremembered... and thought that the eyeball sequence was at the very beginning, but that's DNA Mad Scientist from season one that starts with the eyeball sequence. But here's more eyeball stuff, you know, body horror. I'm a fan of horror movies, you know, and body horror, you know, when somebody's body is transforming in some grotesque way, or not necessarily just gore, but like body horror, like the slow transformation of the main character in District 9, or John Carpenter's The Thing, you know, that kind of horrific monster body horror, you know, kind of stuff. And this certainly qualifies with what they're doing to John. And man, I can see, you know, just logically knowing kind of, you know, about visual effects and stuff, how they did that. I mean, they had Ben Browder. You can just tell by the way the shot is set up how they did the shot, but the prosthetics for his actual eyepieces, even though they're sectioned off by this little frame thing that he's got around him, so that's clearly how they can do kind of like the edit in of the prosthetic version of his eyeballs, but the prosthetics look so stinking good. Watching it this time, and maybe it was a little, maybe I could see things a little bit more in detail because of the Blu-ray, which is, you know, a little bit better. But oh my gosh, that was nuts. That episode, I mean, the episode as a whole doesn't super stand out. But that moment, that scene is like, that's worth watching the whole episode for, you know. Another great scene is when, right after Dargo has been mind cleansed, you know, where he's coming up to John and just like weeping about, you know, how bad he feels about all the things that he's done in his life, you know, and having this heart to heart moment. John's in this contraption. He's like, okay, we'll talk about it later, you know. And Dargo's like, okay. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was great stuff. You know, we see a little bit more about Chiana and her background, and, you know, we got the her brother Neri find out that he's still alive and stuff. I'm trying to remember at this point. I don't remember if they did anything with that. I don't remember if there's an episode after this where she finds Neri or we run into him or he comes back into the story. That might be a thread that was dropped. I honestly don't remember. If it wasn't, then I don't remember really the resolution to it. Anyway, one thing that I was reminded of as I was watching this is, like, you know, we don't really see any Nabari that are like Chiana. That's interesting to me. You know, even like the ones that are like the freedom fighters, the ones that, you know, want to be rebellious and free and whatever, you know, she's our first exposure to a Nabari. And, you know, when she comes on board, you've got the guy that's the Nabari that's overseeing her, you know, who John calls Elvis. And that's a great callback in this episode. He was obviously very, like, sober and steady and flatlined, you know, and that's how the those that are part of the establishment behave. But I'm still kind of waiting and expecting one of these Nabari to show up that's not been cleansed or that's not part of the establishment, that acts in a strange, twitchy way that Chiana does, you know. My guess is that when I can't remember the actress's name, but when she created the character, her intent was to embody, in many ways, who that race is as a whole, you know, or at least the ones that are free and rebellious. But because she's clearly doing some things with her body and her posture and stuff that are strange, you know, and I wish that the other guest actors that came on to play Nabari that were free Nabari would take on some of those attributes. Now, in the defense of the show, I suppose, we see very few of those. In this episode, the one that was, you know, free-minded or whatever, he was an undercover agent, so he had to act flatline. And then when we see in the video recording Neri, her brother, you know, he's a lot more serious and stuff like that, and maybe he just kind of has to be. He can't let himself cut loose the way Chiana does in life because he's leading this whole resistance effort. So, you know, in the show's defense, maybe we haven't seen a Nabari like Chiana in that they are not part of the establishment, not mind cleansed, and they are rebellious like her, you know. So, you know, but anyway, it is just something of note. It's like, you know, she's clearly going for this whole kind of realized alien type character, and we don't really see that reflected in the other Nabari that that come on the show. What else? Oh, I love that this might be the first time that the Scorpius mental clone does something to help John to prolong his survival, you know? And I thought that was just an interesting irony, you know, that, like, this thing that's in his head to menace him and dig into his brain and ultimately, you know, take advantage of him is in this episode responsible for preserving him. So that was a really nice kind of carry through of that whole thread and treating it in a new way. I will say about the opening of the show that I love the whole Winona jamming thing, you know, and how right at the end of that opening, you know, they're talking about jamming and stuff, and then, oh, there's trouble, you know, and even for a, you know, for a moment, I've seen this, I don't know how many times, but for a moment, I forgot about the fact that they were just talking about how Winona jammed, and then when he's pointing this gun at her, this moment of decision where he decides, okay, I'm going to have to kill her. He fires on her and it just poops out a little bolt of light, you know? And it's just like, oh, John. And then he totally gets taken out, you know? So, you know, some great bounces back and forth, as Farscape very often does, between, you know, humorous moments and these, you know, really intense moments. You know, probably the best example of that, the most jarring example of that, is when he's getting his eyeballs sucked out. You know, I mean, that's a cringeworthy moment. And then just seconds later, you know, if you're like me, then we're laughing at Dargo and his mind cleansing behavior. So, great little episode. You know, I'm not sure that it really This is an episode that more is, it's not like a setup episode. It's not an episode that I recall that, you know, is called back to, but sometimes you'll have these episodes that, like, they're not establishing anything. They're just rewarding, your attention to the series, your loyalty to the series. And that's a lot of what was going on here. We had the whole, you know, Chiana's brother, the Scorpius mental clone and a few other things. And of course, you know, just understanding who these characters are and getting to see them, you know, in a slightly different situation. Anyway, so an enjoyable episode, a standout to me, not one of the best, certainly, but it certainly has one of the most memorable scenes for me in all of Farscape with the eyeball sucking out thing. Do you think they pulled his eyeballs out again to get that chip off of the nervy thing of his eyeball? All right, next time we start into what I think is the first full-on we've already had the Look at the Princess trilogy. Okay, but now we've got another trilogy coming up that's a big season ender, and Farscape always does a great job of ending its seasons with these big kind of like cinematic multi-part, you know, arcs. And that's what we've got coming up in part one of Liars, Guns, and Money.